Hey, everybody, this is Justin Michael Williams with Motivation for Black People, giving you trusted guidance to make your life a little bit better.
Or a lot of bit better, I hope.
So I'm super excited for this episode. I'm doing something a little bit special that I do not do often. I think I've only ever done this one other time in the entire 100-plus podcast episode series. And what I want to do is I'm going to play a podcast interview for you where I was being interviewed. And the reason why I'm doing this is because Laura Robbins, who interviewed me from her podcast called The Only One in the Room, it was one of the deepest, most profound, most impactful, most purposeful, most really driven interviews I've ever had the opportunity. Really, I have like the gratitude to even be able to do. And I think what Laura and I discussed and some of the things that I shared and that she really pulled out of me on that interview are things that I have never even thought to speak about with you guys. And I think it's really powerful because, you know, I'm on here so much talking to you guys and, you know, I have my notes sometimes and sometimes you can tell I'm just talking and like letting spirit move me. But when there's somebody else talking to me and interviewing me and digging in with some of these deep questions, okay, she got them like Barbara Walters questions, something magical comes out. And you guys have been on this journey with me for so long that I want to give you the real. You know that's my commitment to you, is to give you like the real deal. And I think in this episode, it takes it to the next level so that you, and this is not about me, right? This is not about you learning about Justin, but it's about the transparency that's happening here so that you can see what it really takes to move forward on your journey. And I hope that this episode inspires you the way that it's inspired, gosh, the thousands of people that have listened on Laura's podcast, The Only One in the Room, and the way that it's actually even inspired me listening back to this and my mom calling me and sending this to my family. And I just hope this one is as special to you as it is to me. And I hope it helps you rise further on your journey. So without further ado, here is my episode with Laura Robbins and Hun from the Only One in the Room podcast. Enjoy.
Can you finish the sentence for me? I am the only
queer black meditation teacher in the room. No experience is wasted. We're exactly on the journey we're supposed to be on, but when we have those whispers and those moments, and we all know when they come in our lives, when they're trying to wake us up mm-hmm. and point us in a right direction, it's our responsibility to move. Imagine living the life that you were born to live. What energy do you need to become that person? What energy do you need? And my instant answer that almost came as quickly as it came when I talked to my grandma was complete authenticity.
Here's a little story about a queer mixed-race black kid from Pittsburgh, California, who was teased for being gay by his peers, got beat up for being too feminine, and never thought that he was good enough. Justin Michael Williams, 32-year-old author, yoga, meditation, and mindfulness teacher, top 20 recording artist and podcast host, showed those childhood doubters that he was not only good enough, but better than them all, making six figures and driving a BMW by the time he was 26 years old. But what if one day your baka, your grandmother, the woman who had always loved you as you were, asked you a question, one that would literally change the way you saw your life forever? Would you ignore her wise words and continue, quote-unquote, living the dream? Or would you answer her question honestly, knowing that your life would never be the same again? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all-too-familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they too had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl, and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. Justin Michael Williams, what was your first car?
Oh my gosh, a green Mustang. It was like a 1995 Mustang.
And did you purchase it yourself?
Oh, no. I was no. My mom and dad helped me with that. Yeah, I was like 16 or 17.
They gifted it to you.
Yeah.
Did you like it? Were you excited?
Oh, I loved it. Mm. Yes, because before that I was driving my grandma's white, like 1980s Toyota something.
Oh, no. You know? And not so, the 1980s Toyota. Mm-hmm,
that's what I was driving when I had my like driver's permit. And then I was like, I want a Mustang. I thought for sure I wasn't going to get it. And I wasn't new by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But it was a Mustang.
Mustangs are great.
Yeah, a lot went on in that car in high school.
Mm.
Yeah.
I had two Mustangs in the 80s. Yeah. 82 and an 85.
Not a
green one. I had a black one and a white one.
It was like that weird, I don't even know what color to call it. It was like that weird turquoise green they used to do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah. It was that one.
That's kind of a dope color.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
It was good.
I like it. I was trying to think of who else had Mustangs. It's you.
Yeah, it was me. My dad had a 65 and a half. I don't know if you remember. They were like famous. They only made them for a little while.
I don't know.
It was green.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh, yeah. So I only saw pictures of it. But
he used to do donuts in them in the parking lot.
He used to do all kinds of stuff in that thing. Yeah.
He has crazy. He started driving at 12.
Oh, wow.
I know. Can you believe that?
Wow.
It was the 80s. Like, yeah. It was much cooler to drive at 12.
He was in Virginia.
Oh, right.
So it was.
See, I didn't do donuts, but I did a lot of things in the back seat of. It's amazing what you can do in the back, which you can pull off in a back seat of a Mustang.
Oh, yeah.
When you're, you know, in high school, it's the only place you have to go.
That should be like their ad campaign. What can you pull off in the back seat of a Mustang?
I'm sure it's been the title of some story.
Yeah, somewhere.
Mm-hmm, right.
All right. I am Laura Cathcart Robbins. This is The Only One in the Room, but I am never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hi, Hun. I just wanted to say how much I'm loving the Roomies, our Facebook group. Creating that community was one of the best things we've ever done.
Yeah, I'm so glad I thought of that.
Did you think of it? I don't really remember it that way.
Well, you know how these ideas are all in the air. Whoever really remembers who said what?
Well, I do. But
yeah, you do.
Let's put a pin in that. So what I want to say is how helpful they've been giving us the questions to ask our upcoming guests.
Yeah, for sure. They've been so great and so active. Didn't they give us a number of questions for Justin?
They did.
Mm-hmm.
So we got questions from Deb All, who said, how can I go deeper into my mindfulness practice? And right Sharon Hart, who asked, how can I use mindfulness to help alleviate anxiety?
Yeah, I can see Justin trying to figure that one out.
Mm-hmm. I got some good answers.
And I loved how a couple of people spoke to the distinction between meditation and mindfulness. Stacey Funk said mindfulness is paying attention to the present moment without judgment, and meditation is the process of turning inward.
That's good.
Yeah. And our beloved Dr. Troy Beyer.
Dr. Troy.
Yeah, Troy. Founder and CEO of Mindful Fitness.
Mindology Fitness.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I just stumbled all over that one, didn't I? She said mindfulness is a noun and meditation is a verb.
Shout out to Troy for that. Thank you, Dr. Troy. We'll see what Justin has to say about that, too. So let me introduce him so he can actually speak. Justin Michael Williams is an author of Stay Woke, A Meditation Guide for the Rest of Us, or is the author of Stay Woke, A Meditation Guide for the Rest of Us. He is a speaker and host of the dope-ass weekly podcast, right?
Mm-hmm.
Motivation for Black People. And a top 20 recording artist who is using music and meditation to wake up the world. By working at the intersection of music, mindfulness, and social justice, Justin has become a pioneering millennial voice for the new healing movement. Justin is committed to using his voice for change, and his greatest wish is to empower people from all walks of life to wake up to their life's purpose and accomplish the dreams they thought were impossible.
Right on. Welcome, Justin.
Thank you, guys. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yes. We're so glad you're here. This was
so
cool.
I'm so happy to be here.
Before we get into your story, a couple things.
We need to once again shout out the homie Jay Connor.
Yes.
His IG handle is at death to adverbs.
We love Jay.
We love him. Mm-hmm. And he was wearing his Hun hat out in the world, representing the only one in the room. And it was a move that attracted your attention, right?
Yeah.
So tell us about
that.
Well,
Jay was wearing this Hun hat. We were actually at, we were being bougie and we were at Soho House. We were at Soho
Jay
Warehouse.
Jay likes to be a little bougie, doesn't he?
Well, it was my membership that got him in.
Snaps.
Oh my God. So anyway, we were at Soho Warehouse and Jay was wearing this hat. Obviously, it just said Hun on it. And I saw it as soon as he came in, I saw it. And I was just looking at it, and I was like, what could that possibly stand for? Because my grandma used to call my grandpa Hun always, and that was the only thing that I could think of. But I just knew in my head, I was like, there's no way it means that Hun.
Right.
Like, oh, Hun. So I just said, what is this H-O-N? And then he just started, gushing about you guys and how amazing. He was like, oh, you guys actually, how do you not know each other? You need to meet. And now we're sitting here right now. So thank you, Jay.
Yeah, he is so good at hooking people up. But we also thought it would be good if you had your own Hun hat.
Oh, shit. I got a Hun hat.
We got a little package for you.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, Jay, we going to wear matching Hun hats, bro.
You guys can bouge it up in the hats, and you'll be...
Oh, my God. Okay, we're going to fit these over these curls.
Over the curls?
This is going to be a whole moment.
Okay. We'll do it later.
This is amazing.
I'm so glad.
Oh, thank you.
Yay.
Oh, I love this.
Yeah, that was a great idea, Hun.
You know, I just did the 5 love languages test. I don't know if you guys have done this.
Yeah.
And I was surprised to find out that, like, my second... highest love language
gifts.
Was receiving gifts.
Yeah.
And so this is making me really happy. Yay. And it's not like, oh, because I like people buying me shit. It's like when the thoughtful moments like this happen.
Yeah. Yes.
It really means a lot. So
I
thank
love
you.
That.
You're speaking
thank
my
you.
Love language.
Mm. Yeah, good, man.
Yeah, so after going back to when he wore the hat and you commented on it, he posted something about you and your book, Stay Woke. And I think it was just a picture, right?
Yeah.
Of Stay Woke and said something that really caught my attention, which was don't buy flowers for Valentine's Day or something like that by this book. So I saw that. I got into the comments and then you and I had this long DM chain and I just shamelessly pursued you as a guest.
I'm grateful.
I'm grateful. Thank you so much for saying yes. But you told a story when we did our pre-interview call about an article that I wrote that kind of started this podcast that gave me like low-key chills.
Mm.
Can you tell that story?
Yeah. So, gosh. So when your article came out, you know, about talking about being the only one in the room at that retreat.
Brave Magic, yeah.
Brave Magic. It was a trip because everybody in my world knows, like, everyone that I've ever spoken in front of or whatever, they know. Even in my book, in the last page of the book, Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic is listed as one of my books that really changed my life. And I've been following her work for a long time. And so when that article came out, tons of people sent it to me. I can't even say tons without thinking of Huns now.
Right.
But anyway. So
tons of people.
Tons of people sent it to me. And they were just like, look, this is you. This is you. Because I have been doing yoga and meditation since I was 18, which is 12 years ago. And no, God, I'm getting older. 14 years ago almost.
How old are you?
I'm 32.
Okay.
Yeah.
You look like you're like a teenager. Go ahead.
No, I'll take it. You know, the black don't crack. We got a lot of problems, but this ain't one of them. So anyway, everybody was sending it to me because I was always the only black guy at all these spiritual retreat centers at different yoga or wellness conferences and stuff like that. And they were like, Justin, look, like, this is probably a lot like your experience. So it's from the moment, I think the day that kind of came out and caught fire, I had known about you and who you were, but I never put that together until this podcast whole situation happened. So it's really amazing.
It's so cool. I love those serendipitous moments. Mm-hmm. There's another word for that I can't think of, but it's not coincidence.
No,
it's divine, like the divine
timing,
energy,
timing. Whatever.
Yeah. Yes. So I don't want to spend too much time on your childhood, but I do want to talk a little bit about how you came to be.
Yeah.
So you grew up in the other Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, California.
Yes.
Yeah, which a lot of people don't
Nobody
know
Nobody knows that. Yeah. Pittsburgh.
People only know it if they grew up in the Bay Area and they ever took the Pittsburgh Bay Point train.
Right,
That's
right.
how people know about it. It's that city on BART.
Yeah. And how was growing up there?
So you know what? It's a really interesting paradox because Pittsburgh, I have so many amazing things that came into my life from growing up in Pittsburgh. Like, it's one of the most diverse cities in all of the United States.
Really?
I think at one point it was on like the top 12 or something like that, and even just in California. And so what was interesting about that is I truly, like, when we were growing up, we had, I had Jewish friends. I was the secretary of the Filipino American Club. I'm not Filipino, but that wasn't weird. It wasn't weird. Like, everybody was just mixed. I was in quinceañeras. Like, we did all these different things. My best friend was Vietnamese. So growing up with that kind of diversity was amazing because it kind of shows you this melting pot of what the world can be.
Right.
I really genuinely, when I was growing up there, really thought racism was like non-existent until I moved out of there and moved to LA. I really didn't know. And so that's a big benefit. But on the, you know, shadow side of things, there was a lot of violence. You know, there are gunshot holes on the outside of the house that I grew up in. Grew up in a home with domestic violence and, you know, something that I think a lot of people deal with is that, and also alcoholism in my family. And so there was a lot of trauma, a lot of love. My parents did the best that they could. They tried so hard. And I think about how young they were, you know, when they 23. I can barely even imagine having a dog now, you know. And my mom had me when she was 23. So it was just, you know, it was rough growing up in that environment. I think one of the toughest things was growing up knowing that I was gay at a really young age. Honestly, people knowing I was gay before I even knew what gay was. And
how did they know that?
I have no idea. I guess it just comes bleeding off of me. But
I have siblings.
I have siblings. Yeah.
Three others?
Three. So I have three younger and one older.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were different from them in that way?
Yeah, different. And this was the thing. I remember the first time, first time. I don't think I've ever told this story. I remember the first time I ever got called gay. And it was when I was in second grade. I was on the playground and we were playing Foursquare, and I had just switched from private school to public school because my parents got divorced and my mom couldn't afford private school anymore. And I'm on the playground playing Foursquare, and it was like these fifth graders there, and I'm the new boy at school. And they're like, oh, he gay. And I was like so confused. I'm like, what's gay? Like, I literally was asking people, what's gay? And so they, the bullies, of course, go in on this joke. And they're like, oh, it means you're happy. It means you're happy. So I start, my dumb ass, I mean, naive, start going, oh, yeah, I'm gay. I'm gay because I'm trying to be like, yeah, I'm happy to be here. I belong at this new school. So I'm walking around all day saying I'm gay. And everyone kind of knows, you know, that what's going on except for me. And I go home and go to my mom. Now imagine this. I go, Mom, guess what? I'm gay. Oh, that didn't go well, you know? And so my mom was like, no, you're not. No, you're not. No, don't you ever say that. That's the disease that God gives bad people who are going to hell. And so, and you know, you're going to get HIV. And I'm like, what's HIV? And she starts telling me about AIDS. And so,
how old are you?
In second grade.
In second grade. Wow.
And so my first ever understanding of gay was that it was something that I needed to be embarrassed about, something people were joking about, something that God gave me because I'm a bad person, something because whatever. I didn't really know anything about it, but I just knew that everyone was calling me, whatever it was, it was, people were calling me it. And then when I came to understand more of what it was and realizing that that's who I was, I fought it for a long time, you know? And that was, I think, one of the biggest challenges of my life. And I think what a lot of queer people deal with is growing up, the thing that I practiced most, and I think most queer people, what we practice most is being someone else so that we can be accepted. And so then for a lot of us, what our greatest life challenge becomes is learning how to be authentic and learning how to be our real selves, because we've practiced our whole childhood learning how to shape shift so that we can feel safe, so we can feel loved, so we can belong. And so anyway, that's kind of the gay story, how that all happened.
That's so interesting. And I just have one follow-up question about that, and then I want to talk about it a little bit more. But they gave it a word when you were eight in second grade. But did you have feelings of attraction for people of the same sex at that point?
Yeah, so you know what? It's so funny you're bringing back these memories that I usually only talk about in therapy, but we're going there. So I remember the first time, so they had already called me gay, and I don't think I paid that much attention. But then soon after that, I remember playing, I was in baseball and I sucked. But my parents had me in baseball. They should have had me in like gymnastics or something. I would have been really good.
You would have. I can just tell.
And and I remember the coach and the kids, like in baseball, you know, they like slap your ass.
Yeah.
Like, good job,
yeah.
good job. And I remember thinking that I liked that differently than the other boys did. And I was like doing things because I wanted to have somebody slap my butt, or I wanted to slap one of the other boys' butt. And that was my first time remembering, oh, this is something that I know is different from the other boys.
Right.
But it wasn't like a sexual thing yet. It just was, I knew I had attraction. But I did very soon after that. I mean, I was like, I think 9 or 10, the first time I had like any kind of a sexual experience with a boy, which is way too young. But it happened, you know, and that's kind of where it all began for me to really understanding, oh, I do like boys. But at the same time, having like full-on relationships with girls all the right. way through high school, and not faking it, like having sex and enjoying it. And, you know, so having these two lives, one that was like very hidden, but where I felt loved and accepted for who I really was, mm-hmm. but only in private. And then the other one that was kind of like the public life that was the Justin that got shown to everyone else.
Right.
Yeah.
So there was this absolute kind of culture of tolerance around race
yeah.
where you grew up.
Yeah.
An intolerance for being gay or queer or lesbian or whatever,
yeah.
any one of those letters.
Or different. Yeah.
And the acceptability around race also ran in your family.
Yeah.
Because you had when your parents got divorced, you had two different cultures, right?
Totally.
Can you talk about that a little
yeah,
bit?
Yeah, so gosh, my family dynamic around race is so fascinating. So my mom is Persian. And she is adopted into an Italian family, okay? And my mom was adopted when she was, I think, 2 days old or something
wow.
like that. And only just until just a couple years ago, which is a whole nother story, we found her biological family.
Mm.
But growing up our whole life, so interesting. My mom, when my grandparents adopted my mom, they were told that my mom was Mexican.
Oh.
So we didn't actually know my mom was Persian until just a few years ago when we did an ancestry DNA test.
Oh, interesting.
So my dad's side is black. Mom is Persian, but thinks she's Mexican, adopted
right.
into an Italian family.
right.
So you see this like identity crisis
right.
happening here.
Yeah.
But like my screen name on AOL Instant Messenger, for people who remember AIM,
mm-hmm.
was Blaxican Boy 22.
Ah.
Like that's how like identified.
So you identified as black and Mexican.
Sí, yo hablo español también.
Ah.
Like everything. And so it's just like very, you know, integrated in that way. But what was also interesting about that growing up that way is, in my home, where I lived primarily with my mom, me and my sister, or if she was gone, just me, I was always the only black guy in the room.
Right.
My grandparents are white. My cousins have blue eyes and blonde hair. Our family parties, like our family Sundays, were huge parties with pasta dinners,
mm.
Italian pasta dinners, where I'm the only black guy in the room. And so growing up, that was just normal to me, being the only, I didn't think about it. It just was normal. And then I'd go to my dad's and then everyone was black.
Right.
Right. So there was this different experience. But what was, there's the positive to that. But then the challenge is in both spaces, I never felt like I fully fit. And I would kind of switch characters. So like when I would go to my dad's side, you know, everyone grew up in Baptist or gospel church. Well, I grew up Catholic with my mom. So I would show up with all my cousins and all these people, and they're singing all these gospel songs that I don't know.
Right.
And I never learned how to play spades. And I never learned, you know, so like,
yeah.
I'm missing a lot of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to this other side with my white cousins, and like, that's a whole different world of things that things that are missing. So there's this funny in-between space that I kind of would sit in where I never really felt like I belonged in both places. And I think a lot of mixed people have that experience.
Yeah. And what you're talking about is code switching.
Totally.
Yeah, between houses, which is when you change the way you speak and how you act and to kind of fit the culture of wherever you are,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
How was your dad about you being different?
You know what's interesting about this? My gosh. My dad was the last person I came out to and the person who I was most afraid of to come out to. I was scared. He's a macho. He was a police officer. He did competitive bodybuilding, you know, so like he was the last person, and I was so scared that I came out to everyone in my family in person. I chickened out and didn't tell my dad, and I told my dad over the phone when I was back in LA in college because I was too afraid. And my dad was the most loving, the easiest of anyone.
Wow.
He literally just said, "Son, I know, and I've been waiting for you to tell me for a long time, and I love you anyways.
Mm.
It doesn't matter who or what. Like, I love you anyways." And I don't know. I think we all have these worst case scenarios of what's going to happen, and it just kind of shows these interesting barriers that happen with masculinity, because I had no expectation my dad was going to respond that way.
Yeah.
And he was the easiest. Everyone else was much more dramatic than him.
Right. So, right. Well, yeah. It sounds like your mother had a really dramatic response.
Oh, she was such a drama queen.
How is she now with it?
Oh my God, y'all. My mom is more of a gay rights activist than I am.
Shut up.
No joke. She was out protesting for Prop 8 while I was in my bed.
Oh.
What's
Prop 8?
Prop 8 was the proposition about gay marriage in
California. Right. Okay, yeah.
From years ago. But my mom, during Pride, will wear a Pride shirt, rainbow. She has transformed dramatically. And we're talking about a woman who, when we were walking down the street in San Francisco when I was a kid, she grabbed our hands and said, "Hurry up, cross the street. Those gay people are coming. We don't want to get HIV. Like, that's how far she's come. I'm so proud of her growth in this. And she's been so open to learning from being super Catholic and not being open to different things to now my mom has crystals and meditates and uses essential oils. So it's been an amazing thing to watch her journey and her growth over this process as well. It's been really inspiring.
You know, when belief systems are passed down from generation to generation like that, to see someone wake up to that maybe the truth is different than this belief system that they've been given from their parents, you know, even if they're not biological, it's still the generation to generation. And to see that the truth is in conflict with that belief system is huge.
Major.
Yeah.
It's a lot of undoing for people. And I think the reason why a lot of people are so resistant to change, or any of us are resistant to change, is because when we learn something new that challenges what we thought was true, then that means now our whole world has to shift a little bit. And we don't want to shift our world, right? Because we're comfortable in our little boxes. But if we're really going to wake up the world, if we're really going to wake up one by one individually, we have to be open to these new truths and being able to hold them all. No alternative facts, but the real truth.
The real,
you know?
Yes, we won't even say alternative facts.
Mm-mm.
Did you have role models growing up?
Oprah. And
Oprah.
My grandma.
Oh, your grandma. I want to talk about her.
Yeah.
Tell me, you identify as queer, is that correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I just went through the letters so I could make sure that everybody understands what they are. So L in the LGBTQIAPK.
Okay, you're adding more letters than I normally add.
So this is what I got.
Take us through them.
L is for lesbian, G is for gay, B is for bisexual, T is for transgender, Q is for queer, which used to be a slur, but has now been reclaimed for people who have same-sex relationships.
Yep.
It can also be questioning.
Mm-hmm.
Q. I is intersex. That's when your assigned gender doesn't necessarily fit with the typical understanding of that gender. A is asexual, someone who's not attracted to anyone of any gender, regardless of gender, rather. P is pansexual, someone who is attracted to people regardless of gender. And K is kink, someone who finds comfort in expressing their sexuality in alternative, counterculture ways.
God, I learn so much every time this happens, and it's so interesting to watch the language become more and more inclusive. And I think the direction that we're headed, hopefully, especially as I look at the younger kids, is that we're not going to need all this shit.
Yeah.
There's going to be so many letters. It's like, all right, y'all.
That's what Scott said. Scott said there are too many letters.
I understand why we have to differentiate so that people can come together and find community in these places where they feel very alone and left out. So I think for that reason, the letters are important. But I think where the world is hopefully headed is into a space similar to what happened or is happening, but with women's rights. It's like at first it's like, separate women, women only, women. And then it's no, women want actually equality and to have the same thing as everybody. And now it's how do we integrate as women into everything that's happening? And so I feel like with the LGBTQ LGBTQIAPK.
Yes.
I usually say LGBTQIA plus is normally what,
right,
what I say.
Right.
It's a plus sign. I think that's what's happening. And a lot of the young kids, they're like, I don't care. I just, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever I am is whatever I am. Like, why do we need to do this?
Shunning the, I think you're right. I think there was a time where we have to honor what the identifier.
Yeah.
Like, say that we see you.
Yeah.
We see that you identify as this and we honor that. And then we can move forward and say, whatever you are, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That the label itself doesn't matter. It's just you.
Yeah. I think in terms of growth, like oftentimes, even just personally, if we pay attention to our own evolution and the collective evolution, we have to oftentimes differentiate first so that we can find our agency in who we are as individuals so that we can then reintegrate into the collective. And integration is where we're the strongest, right? If we're all separated constantly in these different letters, then we're not coming together as a community, but separating into the letters at first helps us come together and find that community.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It was part of the process that needs to happen.
Yeah. And I identify, it's interesting, as queer now. And I remember it was the first article ever that was ever published. It was by Afropunk about my music. And the title of it, and this was in 2016, so queer wasn't quite as claimed yet. Mm-hmm. It was starting to be. And the title of it was Queer Black Musician Releases Haunting New Music Video.
Oh.
And they posted it. And my mom and even me, I was like, what? Like,
right.
And my mom was like, why the are they calling you queer? Like, are they, this is blah, blah, blah. Like, and I was like, I don't know. So they ended up changing it. But it's interesting to watch how that word has been reclaimed. And
yes.
I think it's important, though, because I consider myself like gay-ish mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Like
yeah.
most of the 90% of the time,
mm-hmm.
but there are some moments when I go the other direction. Mm-hmm. So you never know. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
So queer is a good,
a
good word.
I like it.
Yeah.
I was going to read a quote from your book.
Please. Thank you.
When you grow up with violence and abuse, you dream of safety. When you grow up living paycheck to paycheck, you dream of security. When you're from a broken home, you dream of stability. When you're teased for being different, your dream is to belong. When you grow up marginalized, you dream of the same basic rights that seem to be afforded to everyone else by default.
Mm.
So I love all that. I love all that. It really just like settled right in my heart area. And I wanted to talk about when you grow up living paycheck to paycheck, as my family did.
Yeah, mine too.
You dream of security.
Mm-hmm.
How did that affect your ambitions? Because I know that it did. I know before you got to this person that I'm sitting across from, you had ambitions to do more.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Like, so many of us base our desires and our dreams for our lives based on a desire to get out of our current circumstances or just to have the basic needs met. You know, just for... Like, we're like, oh, I can't wait. So I have this job. So I have security. So I have stability. And when that is our aim, we aren't able to actually dream and start living into the real vision that is given to us really by God or the universe or whatever for the big picture of our lives. And I'm not talking about fame or ego. Sure, that's fine if that's in your vision. But I'm talking about going beyond those basic standard needs. And when we grow up in environments when those needs are not met, then it limits our capacity to dream bigger when we start getting old enough to recognize that we have these limitations around us.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you were in that place, you wanted to make money.
Yeah.
So what did you do?
So I started out, my big thing when I was a kid was like, okay, let's go to college. Like, well, it was basically, how do I get out? How do I make money?
Right.
How do I get out? How do I make money? And the way out of the hood.
Out of poverty.
Yeah. Out of the hood. You know?
Out of poverty.
Out of whatever. Like, the only way out that anybody knows of is getting a scholarship to play sports or going to college.
Right.
That's, like, what you're told.
Or
what?
Well, I was saying there's also dealing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which you can do. Or hustling, running numbers. Like, there are other ways, but they're not. They kind of keep you in.
Yes.
But you can still rise to the top of that. Anyway.
And so, yes. And you know, it's interesting because there's all these different routes. And, you know, even me and my siblings, we've all taken different routes. But for me, I think growing up where I was being teased and being bullied and all these kind of things, and also dealing with the paycheck to paycheck and whatever,
right.
My coping mechanism was, I'm just going to be really smart because that's what nobody could fuck with me on. Like, if I'm just smart, and I'm going to get out and I'm going to make money and I'm going to show everybody.
Yes.
You know, and that's what was driving me for so long. And so I went to college, and instead of doing music, even though that's what I really wanted to do, I did marketing. Because I'm not going to get a full ride scholarship to UCLA and then end up broke afterwards doing music.
Right.
You know, because of course I didn't know anybody in my family or around me who was working in the arts or working in their passions and making money. A lot of people had, you know, a lot of our ancestors and the people who come before us, they had to sacrifice those things to try to create stability for us.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, I started out just going to college, doing music. I mean, not doing music, doing marketing. Ended up starting a marketing company when I was 20 years old in college that was really successful. By the time I got out of college, I had an office in Santa Monica with 5 employees, was making 6 figures, driving a BMW. Like, really, you would have thought I was living the dream.
The dream, yeah.
And it was, for a certain extent, it was the dream. But what I didn't recognize until I had this seminal moment with my grandmother was that entire life, that entire dream that I was building was fully based off of my desire to get out.
Yes.
It wasn't based on my desire to fly. That was really built in to my genes.
Your grandmother.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought her up. You called her your baka?
My baka,
yes.
Yeah.
Can you tell me that story that you're talking about?
Yeah, so this is, I think, of anything that I tell on this podcast, I would say this is probably the most important thing that I could share. So several years ago, my baka got diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and the doctors told her she had a couple months to live. It was shocking to our family. She was what I consider young, 67, one of the healthiest people seemingly in our family. And so when I got the news, I flew home to the Bay Area to be with her in Pittsburgh, and I walked in the door, and as soon as I walked in, she pulled me in her room, shut the door, sat me down, and literally asked a question that changed the trajectory of my entire life. She just said, if you were in my shoes and you knew you were going to die in 2 months, what would you do? And you have to remember, at this point, I'm driving the BMW, I'm doing marketing, I think I'm doing on the outside what I was supposed to do to be successful.
Right.
And she just said, close your eyes, get quiet, and listen. If you were in my shoes and you knew you were going to die in 2 months, what would you do? And literally, I felt this like wave of emotion come just running through me, and I just blurted out, I would quit everything I'm doing and I would record an album.
Mm.
I would stop everything. I would just do music. I would throw it all away and do music. And she just looked at me and she was like, I know.
Oh.
Baby, I know. And I was like, you know, what? You know? And she said, ever since you were a little kid, you've always wanted that. That's always been inside of you. But I let all the kids who tease me about being gay, who tease me about being different, all the bullying, all the trauma, the paycheck, I let all that stuff make me think I wasn't good enough or suited for that dream. And I stopped myself. And we all do this. We all have these dreams that we limit ourselves on because we think we're too fat or too old or too ugly or too gay or we waited too long or we're a woman or we're too poor. We all have these things, you know? And in that moment, when my grandma asked me that question, it woke me up to that dream that I almost let die. But the thing is, our dreams, it's very Elizabeth Gilbert, you know, they don't give up on us.
Mm.
They're always right there waiting for us to claim them and make them manifest into the world. So she made me look her in the eyes and promise her that I would do it. And it was amazing. I had this vision in my head when she said that of me sometime later in my life climbing all the way up this marketing mountain, which I would have got to the top too because I'm an overachiever, you know? All the way to the top of this marketing mountain sometime later in life, getting to the top, looking across and saying, damn, I spent all this time climbing to the top of the wrong mountain.
Wow.
And I saw it. I knew that was a reality that would be for me if I didn't make a choice. So I promised my grandma I would do the album, and so grateful to say I stepped into that, and I ended up putting out an album that charted in the top 20, which was blew me the hell away.
Yeah.
And I remember I used to regret that I didn't start music sooner, because when I started, you know, I was like, oh, I'm kind of good. Like, oh, I'm getting better at this. Damn it. Like, what if I would have started when I was 12, you know?
Right.
But it was because of my experience in marketing that my album was able to chart.
Mm.
If it wasn't for that marketing experience, I would have never been able to put out an album that did that as an independent artist. Yeah. And so what I want to share is that, like, no experience is wasted. We're exactly on the journey we're supposed to be on. But when we have those whispers and those moments, and we all know when they come in our lives, when they're trying to wake us up mm-hmm. and point us in a right direction, it's our responsibility to move.
Mm. And that gift, that ultimate gift that she gave you, I'm going to remember that story forever.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And it's just so beautiful. And the way you describe your relationship with your grandmother in the book, I was scared that something was going to happen to her. And then when you said that and I saw what she gave you as a result of finding out about her own mortality.
Yeah.
And how it allowed you to live in a way that you hadn't been able to before.
No.
It's just so beautiful.
Yeah, it was such a gift.
Can you talk to me about Stay Woke?
Yes. Yeah.
So it's a meditation, I'm holding it now, a meditation guide for the rest of us. Who are the rest of us? Do you want to read the...
Do you know, yes, yeah. I was just going to ask you that. So it's on page 3.
Yeah.
It was interesting because the early title for the book before Stay Woke came into play was Meditation for the Rest of Us.
Okay.
So for the rest of us has always been really important to me, and I'll say why later. But when we were writing, I remember one of the notes my editor gave me was, who is the rest of us?
Right.
Don't be afraid. Be specific. Who?
Mm-hmm.
And I was afraid at first. I'm going to leave people out.
Right.
And I was like, no. I know who I wrote this book for.
Mm-hmm.
So this is on page 3.
Okay.
For my Black brothers and sisters, this is for you. For my LGBTQIA+ brothers and sisters, this is for you. For my women who've had enough, this is for you. For my starving artists and workaholic creatives, this is for you. For my conscious entrepreneurs who want to make an impact, this is for you. For those who've been discriminated against for their otherness, this is for you. For my social justice warriors, this is for you. For my tree-loving planet savers, this is for you. And for all people of color, and everyone who is woke enough to understand why I'm pointing that out in the first place, this is for you. This book is for us, for the people.
Yes.
So that's the rest of us.
That is the rest of us. I love that. It was one of the first things that you and I talked about when we talked on the phone. So just talking as a person of color, as a person who's been marginalized for both my gender and my race, probably people who look like me, who are like me, need meditation and mindfulness more than anybody else.
Yeah.
But we're not the population that has the most access to it or the most inspiration to do it. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's so interesting. So if I can be real, I can be real.
So you can be real.
A lot of these practices, the thing that I like to remind people, not a lot of, all of these practices come from people of color. Like originally come from people of color. And what's happened in our history is our practices and our spiritual beliefs and our traditions have been stripped away from us by colonizers, demonized, and then productized and sold back to us. But then they're sold back to us in this way that we feel like we don't relate to. And then it's told that it's not for us, right? It's worshiping the devil. That was one of the things my baka and my mom tried to have an intervention when I first started meditating because they thought I joined a cult.
Wow.
They literally tried to have an intervention.
Like they sat you down and said...
Yes, they came knocking on my door and saying, we need to have a talk, because I had posted something on Facebook about the universe and Mother Earth. And they said, there's only one Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. You know, and I'm not knocking any religion at all. What I'm saying is that when you actually go back to where crystals and honoring the earth and using mindfulness practices and doing all this stuff, these all come from native traditions, African traditions, people of color. That's where it comes from. So what I find is that when we reclaim these practices, when people of color step back into this, it feels like a coming home.
Mm.
That's what everybody says. It feels like a coming home. But the thing is oftentimes it's being taught to us by people who don't have our background, don't have our context, don't have our perspective. So the way they're teaching it to us is in a way that doesn't land.
Right.
It just doesn't, it feels like it doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened to me. It felt, when I first started meditating, it felt like it didn't fit, you know? And then when we start to shift it and see how does this stuff actually apply to the very real struggles and things we're dealing with in our lives, which for most of us, let me just be real, it's not about relaxing.
No.
No. For most of us, not like, oh, let me meditate so I can relax. No. Sure, Okay, like we want to be more relaxed, but like how do we use meditation to become more alive? Mm-hmm. How do we use it to become more connected to our passions, to overcome toxic habits, to step into the lives that we're born to live, to stop the internalized oppression that's coming on many of us? That's why I'm interested in teaching meditation, and that's what the book is all about.
Mm. I was just like totally transfixed
Thank
by
you
then. On page 2 of your book, you say, "I have a confession to make. This is not really a meditation book." And then you say something else, but I'm just going to tell you that Scott and I have a friend named Sunny.
Okay.
Shout out to Sunny, wherever you are.
Sunny.
She says she's never been able to meditate. And I bring her up because I thought of her while reading your book, especially when you said, if you can worry,
yeah,
then you can meditate. Is
yep.
that what you said?
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So just talk about that for a minute.
Yeah. So the this is not really a meditation book piece is important because the real truth is, like, I don't give a shit about meditation. I'm using meditation. And the only reason I teach meditation is because it is the tool that has transformed my life most. It is a tool that we get access to use that can help us change our lives. So the book is about you stepping into your purpose. It's about guiding you through a process of stepping into your passion and overcoming self-sabotage. And meditation is the tool that helps us get there. Mm-hmm. And when people come to me and say, "Oh, I can't meditate. I just can't get my mind to stop thinking. I just can't." Look, I've been there, right? Oh, every time I sit down, my mind just starts going crazy. You know, I just can't do that. I meditate when I run. I meditate when I cook, you know, yeah. whatever. This is what we all say. This is the thing. I said, if you can worry, you can meditate. They're literally the same thing. Worrying mm-hmm. is what happens. You're thinking of something, some doom and gloom thing that's going to happen. And no matter what you're doing throughout your day, you're just letting your mind return to it over and over and over. You could be driving, you could be walking, you could be talking, you could be trying to think positive. You keep coming back to that same worry. That's the same thing as meditation, except we flip the switch from worrying to empowerment. Mm. And instead of choosing on something to worry about that we keep coming back to, we choose something that's going to take us towards our growth.
Wow.
And a mantra really being like an affirmation or a word or a phrase or something that we're using that's taking us towards who we want to be. And this is how, you know, people say, "I can't get my mind to stop thinking." First of all, you can't. It's the biggest myth about meditation that people think they have to get their minds to stop thinking. So you're not going to. That'd be like saying, "Oh, I'm going to meditate. I need to get my heart to stop beating now."
Right.
Like, it's bullshit, right? The mind's going to think. What people want is not to stop thinking. They want to get their thoughts to work for them instead of against them.
Mm.
So many of us, our thoughts are running us. They're running our lives and they're working against us. The goal is to get them to work for us.
I love that. And I mean, you have to listen. You have to listen to this podcast, but you have to read this book because there's just so much in it that I didn't know. And I meditate. I have a meditation practice. But the tips and the tools and the stories that you use to get people in. And there's something that you say, we're not monks, was that it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We have trouble thinking about meditation is because it's like we live in this technological world. You know what I'm talking
yeah.
about?
Okay. Yeah.
That part.
Yep. It's right here, actually. Do you want it or do you want me
you,
to have
You
it?
Read it.
You want me to read this?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So this is a part that you're talking about. Throughout my last decade of teaching yoga and meditation, I've been blessed to work with thousands of people of all types of backgrounds from more than 40 countries around the globe, and everyone says the same thing. I've tried meditation, but I just can't stick with it, or I just can't get my mind to slow down, or I don't believe in meditation. And the thing is, I actually understand why. And that's because meditation, at least the kind of meditation that most of us have heard about, started with a bunch of men
right.
who were monks
yes.
sitting in the forest. And to become a monk, you had to release and abandon your entire family, all of your friends, all of your internal desires. You had to give up sex and passion and intimacy and all of your emotions and all of your needs, including hunger and thirst and everything you love. You had to literally renounce all of it, sit under a tree, and devote the rest of your life to God.
Right.
Sounds intense, right?
Yeah.
Right? It was, and it was so intense that the ancient monks had to use special techniques to help them totally abandon their worldly desires, and the most powerful technique that they created was meditation. But the thing is, we are not monks. We are modern people in a high-tech world. We have first-world problems and shit to do. We have iPhones and social media and emotions that keep us connected to our passions and our dreams and to one another. We have relationships and kids and jobs and long to-do lists. And if you grew up like me, overcoming systemic oppression, homophobia, sexism, depression, poverty, toxic masculinity, racism, or trauma, You need a different type of meditation, one that doesn't pretend that your struggle doesn't exist.
Yes.
So that's the...
I love that.
That's
I love
the juice of the book.
Well, it felt really freeing to me because if you're bound to this one idea of what meditation is, and you're right, you illustrate the world we live in so well, it's just going to keep getting busier and more technological as we advance. So to have a tool that works, and what's really great about your book too, and I haven't gotten through all of it yet because I just got my advanced copy recently.
I know, we rushed it to you.
Yes, you did. Thank you so much. And shout out to Nick for doing that. But you say it's passed, like recipes are passed down from generation to generation, especially in our culture.
Yeah.
That's our history.
It is.
Because we were cut off from the rest of our history.
Yeah, we don't got no 400-year-old jewels.
No,
stuff,
we don't.
You know.
No, we don't.
From our ancestors. We got recipes.
We got recipes. Yeah. And I love your description of sitting with your grandmother and the pinch of this and the there is no writing anything down or scribbles.
Yeah.
But anyway, this book is set up like a recipe book so you can individualize it.
Yeah.
And you can take, you know, what you want from the beginning and then figure out how to use it.
Yeah.
In the rest of the book. It's genius.
Thank you.
It really is.
Oh.
Right now we're going to go to the Dear Laura that I talked to you
about. Dear Laura.
Yes. And this is from our Facebook group. And I don't know if he wanted his name used, so we'll just leave him anonymous for right now. It says, Dear Laura, can you address the difference between mindfulness as opposed to mindlessness? I mean to say, do we need to slow down and be aware? Sure. And do I need to grasp and savor every flavor or enjoy washing the dishes with all my attention? Maybe. But a constant practice that is part of a regime akin to some pious protocol so I can live a better life? Nah. I just live and expect great things. What do you think?
Okay. I love this.
Yeah, so we gotta kind of dissect this and take it apart. What do you get from it?
Okay, so what I am understanding that he's saying, I'm calling him Hun 2.
Oh, Hun 2.
There is no Hun 2. There's only one Hun out here.
Well, you're about to be a Hun with your hat on.
You are. So. I am about to be a Hun.
Yeah.
I'll you
be
and
Hun,
Jay.
Me and Jay will be right. Hun 3 and 4. So what I'm getting at the essence, you know, I had my eyes closed just kind of listening to the core of what he's saying is, why do I have to do this daily pious practice that's part of some tradition or regime for me to enjoy my life?
Right.
That's
what I think he's asking.
That's the essence of the question, right? And ultimately, here's the deal. So many of us have so much practice at pushing things down to try to, quote unquote, live our life. But when we're doing that and we're pushing things down, we don't even recognize what's running our lives from the background. And there's a lot that's running our lives from the background in the shadows. And what I say is that if we don't set dedicated time to be alone with ourselves, so many of us have so much trouble being just alone in silence with ourselves. It was hard for me when I first started because we don't have practice at doing that. If we can't do that, how can we ever expect to really know ourselves? How can we ever expect to really know what the path is for our lives, to listen to the whispers? Look, this is one of the things that I like to say, and whether you believe in God, the universe, whatever, just for the sake of this, I'm going to say God. Prayer is when you talk to God. Meditation is when you listen to God talking back to you.
Mm-hmm.
We spend so much time asking, praying, what should I do? Show me the way. I don't know what to do next. I don't know. I got to ask. I'm got to call him. Got to call her. If we don't sit down and get silent with ourselves, then we don't have a relationship with the deepest part of ourselves that actually knows which way to go. And this is why it's not about becoming a part of a regime or becoming part of a tradition. It's literally about you setting time aside in your life for you to actually build a relationship with the most important person in your life, which is you.
Wow.
And that's it. That's what it's all about.
I love that answer.
Oh, thank you.
That's so perfect. It's like you had that prepared.
No,
you
I
didn't.
I did not.
No. You know, I just have to say that when you arrived, well, first of all, you know, we had to push the session because part of the ceiling fell down in our studio.
So wild.
And it had to be like cleaned up and set up. And then when you arrived, I was ready to jump right in because I wanted to be really mindful of your time. And you asked us to take a full minute of silence with a timer and reset ourselves. And several times when I've been talking to you or reading your questions, you've closed your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I hope if you're listening to this, you check this out on YouTube as well, because you are worth watching.
Oh.
You really walk the talk.
Oh, thank you.
And I can tell that just from the short time that we've been in each other's presence and the time that we've been on the phone. And if you wrote this book, you're walking the talk, and you did. It's really amazing, and it's refreshing sit across from someone who's not just about self-promotion, but about promoting something that is of service to the world. So thank you.
That really means a lot. Yeah, I think that it's more important now than ever that we are walking the talk. And it was one of the things that I committed to when I got into this practice of getting even ready to write the book and getting ready to do this, is just not wanting to be one of these teachers who, and I'm so sad, I've met so many of them who, like, they have these amazing books and these amazing teachings, and you meet them and they're like an asshole and don't do any of the practices, you know? And it doesn't have to be that way. There are people, what I'm so empowered by is there are so many people of color, so many Native people, so many trans people, so many that are like stepping up into their power as leaders of this new healing movement. And what I mean by the new healing movement is the healing movement that is inclusive for all of us. And I just feel really honored to be, you know, a part of it.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful.
Well, I didn't know about that new healing movement until I read it in your book. So we're going to be aware of that.
You're a part of it too?
Yes, I am.
This podcast is healing people.
Hey.
Like, seriously healing people. So
thank you.
You've been a part of it without even knowing.
Thank you. Back to the post that we talked about, Jay Connor's post. We talked about that at the top of the episode. Hun saw Jay Connor's post too. And he secretly pre-ordered Stay Woke for Me for Valentine's Day.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Shout out to Nick for blowing that gift. Now I'm going to get another one.
But
that's all right.
But
we got a plan for
it. We didn't know that Nick Small from Sounds True.
My publicist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Had already mailed. Oh, he didn't know. He had already mailed me an advance copy. So since we have two copies of your amazing book, we're going to give one away.
Yeah,
to the first person to post a link to this episode with the caption, "I want my own Stay Woke," in our Facebook group.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So whoever you are, get to posting.
Yeah, and after that, we'll reach out to the winner. We'll get your mailing address, and we'll send you a copy of this incredible book.
Incredible book.
You know what? Let's give away two. I want to give one away.
You
want to
give one away?
Too.
Okay.
All right. We'll give away two.
We'll let the second one just be at random, so people can post, and then we'll pick a random. So the first person.
We'll pick the one we like the most.
We're going to put you in on the chain, all right?
Yeah, the person with the best picture.
Yes.
I'm just kidding.
Right? Send a picture of you meditating.
Yeah.
Nothing happens without a reason, right?
Right.
Nope. Okay. thank you guys for doing that.
Of course.
Yeah, man.
So when is your book available to the public?
February 11th,
okay.
2020 is the pub date.
Yes.
Yeah, that's when it's available, and it's available everywhere.
So it's available basically now as people listen to this podcast.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Perfect. So the book is available now.
Yes.
Barnes & Noble's, Amazon, everywhere.
Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. And what else are you doing? Are you doing a book tour? Are you?
Yeah. So this is one of the most important things that I want to make sure that people hear on this podcast. So instead of going on a traditional book tour, which for people who know, it's like a traditional book tour is you go to like these kind of indie bookstores and these affluent areas. And I can do that. But I wrote this book for the rest of us. And so one of the things that we're doing with this that is so amazing that my publisher said yes to is we're going to some of the most impacted cities in the United States, places like Southside Chicago, Flint, Michigan, Oakland. We're going to my hometown in Pittsburgh, LA, and we're doing free mass meditation assemblies at high schools and colleges in all the cities, and we're giving away books to everyone, to every student.
Look at you.
Every single student. We're giving, like in my hometown, there's 3,500 kids in the high school. Every kid's getting a book. We're doing these big events that are kind of like a big kind of TED Talk event for the kids. And then at night, we're doing an evening event that's open to the public in each city. And so one of the things that's amazing is we're trying to take this to as many cities as we possibly can. And we're already going to a bunch. And so people can actually donate to help us take this just around the world as into as many cities as we possibly can. And it only costs $8 per kid to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And to donate, you just go to staywokegiveback.org. And on that website, you'll also see the other tour dates and when you can come to the public events with us in person. Yeah, so like even more than I want people to pre-order my book, which I'd love for you, I mean, to order the book or buy the book, like I would love for us to be able to give this back to the kids. Because if we can just think of our childhood selves and imagine what our lives might be like if we had tools and a language to deal with some of the shit that we grew up with. And so that's what I'm actually the most excited about. So it's at staywokegiveback.org, and Ooh. We can help a whole bunch of kids feel a little bit more love in the world.
That is dope.
Thank you.
And we'll put that in our show notes too, so they can just click on that link right there listen to the episode.
That means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. Anything else that's coming up for you? That's a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot happening. You know, this is a really big year, and I think a lot of us are feeling that.
Mm-hmm.
2020 is a big year for a lot of reasons. And, you know, my main mission is to make sure that we have community to come together to during the turbulent time so that we can find our center and continue going towards our purpose and
Ooh.
Making sure we can see this world showing up
yes.
the way that we all know that it can. And
yes.
the reason why meditation and stuff is so important is because this is how we're going to stay centered in the middle of all the craziness that's to come.
That's incredibly fantastic.
Mm. Yeah.
It's so brilliant.
So there's a lot of things. People, if you just look for me online, you'll see there's a new music that just came out and a new song called I Am Enough and the book and the tour. And so there's so many places that I can meet people in person or online. And I'm just grateful to be a part of this community with all of you.
Mm.
Wow.
Just really quick last thing. In 2016, prescription drugs for Xanax and all the benzos, the use of those went up tremendously.
Yeah.
And that was an election year.
Yeah.
And this is another election year with a lot of the same things at stake.
Yeah.
So to have this as an antidote for that or a tool
yeah.
is really incredible. And I'm so glad you just said that.
And science, this is the thing. And people think it's woo-woo. It's not woo-woo. This is like you can look up scientific proven journals
yeah.
that meditation and a regular mindfulness practice has some of the same benefits as they found with taking antidepressant medications mm-hmm. and anxiety medications. Oh, yeah. Same.
Yeah.
Same when they've done studies with people. And it's free. Has no side effects and doesn't it's something that we can do.
Yeah.
And so if it was a pill, clearly people would take it because they're
sure.
taking it.
And pay big money for
they
it.
They would pay for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And so we can do this. And all it takes is 12 minutes a day.
Mm.
That's what the studies are showing. 12 minutes is the minimum suggested dosage. So it doesn't take all this time. We have time and we can do this. We just got to commit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
On social media, I know on IG you're at We Just Will.
Yep. That's everywhere.
It's everywhere?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So is it Twitter?
Twitter, at We Just Will.
Okay. Are you on Facebook?
I'm on Facebook, Justin Michael Williams.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, good. So we'll invite you to the Facebook group.
Yeah.
So you
My
can
podcast,
see the post-it
people
pictures.
Can listen to the podcast, Motivation for Black People.
Yes, yes.
So yeah.
We'll put a link to that too.
Oh, thank you. This is so nice with all my links.
You're
going to have a lot of links.
Thank you so much. Thank you so
you.
Much. This is brilliant. It's been an experience, a spiritual experience for me.
Oh,
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I just want to say, you know, before I sign off, like what you guys are doing is so crucial and so important and so mm-hmm. vital to humanity at this time to make sure that people know that even though sometimes we feel like we're the only one, that we're all together
yes.
and we're not the only one. And so these stories are so empowering and so impactful. So I thank mm-hmm. you and I honor you so much. It's a privilege to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and stay tuned for our bonus after show, Scott Talks, coming up next.
Ah, you guys, Justin, I'm back. That episode, like just me listening to it again, you know, it's so deep. And I hope that you were able to see, you know, some of the ins and outs of this journey and that it inspires you to know that no matter what you're going through in your life, no matter how you grew up, no matter who you love, no matter what you got going on, that you can and you will, and we are in this thing together, right here with you together. So I want to thank Laura Robbins and Hun, who's her man that she talks to on the episode, and the Only One in the Room podcast. And I think this is such a powerful podcast because she interviews people who are often, like us, the only one in the room, you know, the only Black person in the room, she recently had an episode called The Only Black Republican in the Room, which was really interesting. So make sure you go check out her podcast. The stories are fascinating. And I think things that so many of us can relate to or find interesting. And as you saw, she's just the most amazing interviewer and host. And I learned so much from her. So thank you guys for being on this journey with me. I love you. I thank you. I honor you. This has been Justin Michael Williams signing out, and I will talk to you on the next episode.